Hello, everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics, manga, and all their related spin-offs. I'm Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Rob.
Hello!
And as what is becoming, per usual, no Mick.
Yeah, he's ill.
Or at least that's what the version of Mick dressed entirely in a red bodysuit who could only communicate in a weird choking howl told us.
Yep. Today we're doing all comics. It's our monthly comics extravaganza.
Anyway, yeah, it's a comics review special, so without further ado, Rob, give us some comics.
Well, we have plenty to talk about today between the two of us. I'm going to kick things off with Old Man Hawkeye, Volume 2, or the second part of it, which is The Whole World Blind. This is written by Ethan Sachs, with art by Marco Cecchetto, Ibrahim Robertson, Francesco Mobili, colours by Andres Mosser, letters by VC's Joe Caramagna, cover art by Marco Cecchetto, and edited by Mark Basso. It's Hawkeye in kind of the world of the old men. So, Old Man Logan, Old Man whatever.
I do, but I like the idea that this is specifically an alternate universe where every superhero has become an old man.
Yeah, but I think the difference between Old Man Hawkeye and Old Man Logan is this kind of goes into detail about what happened to the other heroes and what
happened. Where's my old man Squirrel Girl, Rob?
Well, Squirrel Girl is probably one of the few who is going to turn up at some point. So this actually starts off not quite where the first volume left off. The first volume left off with Hawkeye killing a couple of the old members of the Thunderbolts who betrayed him and everyone else. And this actually explains how they betrayed the Avengers and everyone. The Avengers were off on a mission. So you have Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch and Falcon, Captain America, Black Knight, Thor. And you had various others. And you had Black Widow and Hawkeye, and they're off on another merry adventure, but this time they need a bit of extra muscle, so the Thunderbolts have come along for the ride. And so you've got the Thunderbolts, who I can't remember. There was Songbird, and there was it Atlas?
Yeah, Songbird, Atlas, Mac, who like changed his name from like Mac 2 to Mac 10 or whatever, the Fixer, Moonstone, and I think originally Citizen V, who was actually Baron Zemo in disguise.
Yep.
And I think that's the original Thunderbolts.
Yep, that was the original Thunderbolts. They run into a kind of a Sinister Six type environment, or whatever you want to call it, but there's way more than six. Then you've basically got the Abomination, Hobgoblin, Magneto, who's brought their plane down, Sandman, Crossbones, and various other people who are up against the Avengers, and they're all fighting each other, Magneto kills Scarlet Witch.
Well, that's not very nice of him.
Yeah.
I guess he just got annoyed with her being his on-again, off-again daughter.
Well, he's crying when he does it, so that apparently automatically absolves him of any guilt.
He's crying because he's so confused.
Yeah.
Am I related to you or not?
What's his name? Is his name Sandman? Yeah, the Sandman. He breaks Quicksilver.
Is he the man who's made out of sand?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, that's Sandman.
Yeah, I get confused between him and the other Sandman, you know, the real Sandman.
What, the Sandman who lives in all our dreams? Because dreams are stories, I'm Neil Gaiman. Let me take you away on a magic adventure. I've no idea if this is what his voice sounds like. I've just arbitrarily decided it is.
Yeah, it's not that Sandman, it's the other Sandman, the one who's made of sand. So Thor is up against Magneto, the master of magnetism, and apparently Thor can't beat Magneto because Magneto has the power of magnetism, which apparently cancels out electricity.
Yes, because magnets, how do they work?
And somehow Magneto channels Thor's electric powers into the Absorbing Man, and the Absorbing Man basically kills Thor, which, yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I love that Magneto is the most powerful supervillain in the world because no one has any goddamn idea what magnetism is.
Even more than that, You have what's the guy with the kind of cape and sword and the white mask? You know, the red, the stars and stripes cape. And
oh, that is in fact Citizen V.
Yes.
Who, spoiler alert: is Baron Zemo.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. Thing is, he wasn't Baron Zemo until about a week before all this happened, when he killed Citizen V and took his costume. So he wasn't Baron Zemo all the way through. He actually reveals in this that he killed Citizen V, took his costume, and then kills Black Widow in front of Hawkeye.
I guess like he killed, because I think Baron Zemo was Citizen V, then he got found out, then I think someone else took over like as Citizen V, and then like that's probably who he killed.
See, Baron Zemo leaves Hawkeye alive for one reason. Hawkeye's the only one without powers. Or the only one without any real kind of spy training. The only one, because even Black Widow would have been a threat to the Red Skull and Baron Zemo, because she's got skills that Hawkeye doesn't have.
I hate that.
Yeah, I know. That's my one big complaint about this, is that
especially the Hawkeye led the Thunderbolts.
Yeah, but apparently they betrayed everybody, and the Thunderbolt and Hawkeye didn't know anything about it.
Which, I mean, also is not within their characters, yep. And it's more of the, it's Hawkeye, he's the useless Avenger.
See, aside from that rather disappointing look back in time at Betrayal of the Thunderbolts, yada, 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 you have Bullseye roaming around this post-apocalyptic future, or Old Man Deathlok Bullseye, because he is kind of part Deathlok now, using his Deathlok technology to get a cybernetic eye, which makes him look a lot like Deadshot.
Yeah, I guess I can see, if you like, you put the sort of monocle thing on him. Yeah, they're basically the same.
That's basically what Bullseye is now. He's Old Man Bullseye, or Old Man Deathlok Bullseye. Old Man Deatheye? Old Man Bullock?
I think Old Man Deatheye just has really bad glaucoma.
Exactly. And Old Man Bullock is a totally different character. So anyway,
Old Man Bullock is just Harvey Bullock.
Exactly. So anyway, Bullseye kills Winter Soldier with the trident, of all things.
Sure, of course.
Clint is going around looking for old members of, what were they called again? I keep forgetting the name.
The Thunderbolts.
The Thunderbolts, that's it.
They strike justice like lightning.
He's going around looking for the old members of the Thunderbolts who betrayed everybody and caused the death of basically all of the Avengers. And he's going around to kill them. Kate Bishop is kind of helping him because Clint's eyesight is going. Half his sight is almost gone. And he finds Songbird at the Sanctuary of the Silent Sisterhood, where she basically writes down, I'm sorry, she's sworn never to speak again. She broke up with, was it Atlas she was going out with?
I think it was Mac she was going out with. And also, she is a legitimate hero in her own right, and this series is doing her dirty.
The thing that annoyed me about this is Songbird is one of the few characters in this who I feel is hard done by, because it doesn't seem in her nature to betray the rest of the heroes in any way, shape or form. The only thing that kind of is within her nature is the fact that she did something wrong and she's been seeking penance for it, which means she probably wouldn't have done something wrong in the first place.
Yeah, because like the whole point, she's one of the Thunderbolts who genuinely reformed and like became a hero. Like, it was her and Mac who were like the ones who actually went on to become real superheroes and like kind of co-lead the Thunderbolts for a while.
Who was the guy with the big A on him in the Thunderbolts?
That's Atlas.
Yeah.
Weren't you can tell because of the big A.
Yeah, weren't they an item or something?
No, I don't think so.
I think they might have had some kind of friendship or something like that, or relationship of some sort.
Well, they're all kind of good birds.
Yeah. But anyway, Songbird in this says that she, after everything happened, she left Atlas and basically took shelter in the convent and never spoke a word again for however many years it's been. Anyway, we go on to the Weapon X facility in the Canadian Rockies. Avalanche is there, and he's basically blowing people's heads up. Songbird gets killed, more by Bullseye, and then things go on. You eventually, in this, get to meet one of Hawkeye's other old friends, Carla Sorfin.
Yeah, that one's Moonstone.
So she's become very, very twisted over the years, so Hawkeye kills her, That one is actually kind of perfunctory. It's over very suddenly. There's very little build up to it, and there's very little in the way of payback. He basically kills her, job done, that's it. Apparently, Hydra figured out the Super Soldier formula, and they've got their own version of Captain America called Captain Hydra, or whatever he's called. And Baron Zemo. You get to meet Baron Zemo. But Baron Zemo is seriously pissed now, because where he left Hawkeye, where he basically left Hawkeye alive to kind of wallow in self-pity and in how helpless he was, Baron Zemo is exactly the same now.
You stupid dummy, Zemo.
Yeah, because Baron Zemo is now having to breathe through a tube. Because Baron Zemo has some kind of debilitating disorder. I've forgotten what it was. Was it a motor neuron or something like that? He is basically barely alive as it is. He's being kept alive by machines and breathing tubes and stuff like that. And he's a mess. His body's a mess. Whereas Hawkeye only has one problem. His sight's going. Which Avalanche then duly sorts out by taking away the rest of his sight. So Hawkeye is now fully, fully blind. And Kate Bishop is sick of the fact that Hawkeye is basically out on a quest to kill himself. Revenge being a circle, everything like that. So drops him off at one of his other old friends, which is a farm that has the post box that says Logan on it.
Yeah, it's like we've gone full circle.
Yeah, but not quite full circle, because the next thing you see is Hawkeye climbing the mountains to meet the Grand Master of Martial Arts, also known as Stick, and he wants Stick, the blind martial artist, to teach him how to use his other senses. And you know what? Stick agrees, because he and Hawkeye are actually old friends.
Two training montage to you're the best.
Yeah, but guess who's teaching him?
Stick.
Not the old Stick.
Oh, I get a Daredevil Stick now.
Yep.
I mean, that's probably a spoiler. Whatever.
There's going to be spoilers in the stuff we talk about today anyway, so sorry if it's a bit late, but spoiler alert.
That's good, Rob. That's the professionalism people expect from this podcast.
Look, Old Man Hawkeye is one of those comics that it takes a bunch of characters who you know what they're like already. You know there are certain behaviors that these characters just wouldn't engage in. And they've basically done something similar to Elseworlds with it, but not quite. It's close enough to the main timeline for there to be an element of doubt, I suppose. But it would be nice if they actually understood the characters before they put pen to paper, before they started saying, oh yeah, these guys were bad guys once, and so they'll be bad guys again. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, that just seems a very easy cop-out.
It is. It's like the whole thing with Old Man Logan. The one thing I hated about Old Man Logan was when it came to the whole Sons of Hulk thing.
Yeah, everything. Old Man Logan is like five very good issues and then one very, very bad issue.
Yep. And the Sons of Hulk thing assumes that Hulk was stable enough to actually have kids in the first place.
I mean, it's just everything. It's just, you know, Mark Millar.
Yeah.
Just... yes, we get you. You're very edgy and cool. Go away now, please.
Go be edgy and cool in the right comics. Preacher was edgy and cool, but that was the right comic to be edgy and cool in.
It also wasn't written by Mark Millar, which I think is a big point in its favour. Oh, God,
you know, it's Warren Ellis, wasn't it?
Garth Ennis.
No, sorry,
Garth Ennis.
I always get confused between the two of them. Damn it.
It's like how Marvel at the moment have a writer called Matthew Rosenberg and a colorist called Rochelle Rosenberg.
Do you know what it is?
Millar... and they're not related. Al Ewing and Eve Ewing aren't related either. It's weird.
Do you know what it is? Millar has two L's in, and I'm thinking Warren Ellis. Millar Ellis. The L's is what's drawn me to that. And then still getting it wrong because it's not Warren Ellis.
Weird. Anyway, we'll go from too many L's, you bub, to some Beelzebub.
Oh, God. That was torture.
No, no. No, we're going to have to cancel the show. I've sinned too far.
That was like a Monty Python crucifixion.
BPRD, the W, no pandemonium, volume 2. So this is continuing where we left off the BPRD. They've basically gone through a period of war and strife against various supernatural entities, where the Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense have emerged victorious against the forces of the Ogdru Hem, but at the cost of large swaths of the world. However, the attempts by the worldwide governments to rebuild have been somewhat stymied by the appearance of Varvara, a mysterious Russian girl who has been assembling a cult of villains and former Hellboy enemies for some kind of unknown spooky purpose.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, wait, this has a story by Mike Mignola and Scott Alley, with art by Sebastian Fiumara, Lawrence Campbell, and even a bit of art by Mike Mignola himself.
Ooh.
And colours by Dave Stewart and letters by Clem Robbins. So, yeah, as I said, this is about the BPRD continuing their attempts to find out just what the heck this Varvara's up to and stop all her weird devil-summoning shenanigans. Except they now have a new ally to help them out. It's Hellboy.
How old is Hellboy now?
Where is it? 50, 60 odd. Anyway, the point is Hellboy was dead and now he's not anymore. But all does not seem to be well. Because Hellboy is kind of very out of it. Just sort of spends a lot of this volume sort of standing around the BPRD. And basically the helicarrier that they have now. Just sort of giving kind of one or two word answers. Like, I think it's like, we've got to go save the world. And he's just like, oh, okay. And he's clearly, he's not come back right. And there's some kind of mystery also involving Roger the Homunculus.
Okay.
That's going on. And a lot of it also is just the BPRD kind of sort of gathering their forces and working out the mysteries. It's a bit more kind of Ashley Strode, their resident exorcist. She interrogates one of Varvara's cultists, who is revealed to actually be a zombie. And sort of has some kind of weird vision quest where she also sees a bunch of devils. But this all leads to them going for a big final confrontation in New York City.
Always the best place for final confrontations.
It is.
You know, not much room to swing a punch, loads of buildings knocked down, people running, screaming.
I mean, to be fair, at the place it's in now, there is quite a lot of room to swing a punch. Because a lot of those buildings have already been brought down.
Okay.
But yeah, it's good, meaty, high stakes, living the apocalypse. And of course, it's always, I like a nice story that's just, okay, here's what's going on. We're going to lay all our cards down on the table.
See, I like that when a story's nice and straightforward and just tells you exactly what's going on and doesn't try to be convoluted.
I mean, it's still convoluted in the sense of, like, people's stomachs being opened up, but actually maybe it's really their souls and having demons placed inside them.
Ooh.
And, like, weird orb monsters that run on spindly tripod legs and have big mismatched teeth, and God, they're very creepy. I like them a lot.
Yeah, but you do like stuff like that.
I do. I don't like that. It's weird monsters and kind of just kind of a Hellboy greatest hits in terms of character reunions.
I'm glad you said in terms of character reunions, because when you just said Hellboy greatest hits, I was just imagining the different punches that Hellboy has given.
I mean, he does do some great hits as well with his big stone fist.
Exactly. I was like, there's that time he punched that rat monster. There's that time he punched the giant snake.
That's funny, because you got Hellboy, you got your little Sherman, you got Abe, you've got a new guy whose name is Agent Howards, and he's like this big Conan the Barbarian type. And I've realized at the end of this volume, I've been referring to him as Agent Todd Howards, but also that's Todd Howard, like the chief of Bethesda.
Oh, please say it is bottled on him. Just like,
and like I don't know if his name is actually Todd now. I just keep calling him Todd Howard.
Oh, we'll look into this and find out.
Right. And yeah, and it ends with another character returning, one who's perhaps somewhat unexpected, in the words of Hellboy himself, ahem, son of a bitch. Because that's just how his volume ends, with Hellboy saying that. And then, next, he You know, no, I'm not even going to say what the next is, because that's quite a big spoiler for the thing that I've deliberately avoided not spoiling.
Well, Hellboy saying son of a bitch and then you don't want to spoil it. Can I make a guess in the form of a tune?
I mean, yes and yes. It is. That's who you're thinking of.
Is it that one?
I think so, but that's not the tune, Rob.
No, that's the beginning bit. Then it goes dun 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 da 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 da.
Yeah, there we go.
I just didn't want to do that bit because that kind of gives it away.
It's Rasputin.
You did it.
I wasn't going to, but it's hard because I feel like that's the main thing I really like about this. It's like it's taking a character. It's like it's kind of having your cake and eating it too, where you get like all of Hellboy Rasputin never being as big a threat as he thinks he is.
Yeah.
But now, kind of bringing it back around for no surprise, you get your big final battle where it's like all the Hellboy characters versus Rasputin.
Yeah, because he is a bigger threat than anyone thinks he is.
Yeah, and it turns out Vivara is actually his daughter, and like this has all been one long plan by his.
Wow. Rasputin is one of those characters who I love seeing in fiction because he was so mysterious in the first place as a historical figure. And the fact that they just couldn't kill him. And then he predicted that if he died at the hands of nobility, then the Russian Revolution would happen. The nobles were the ones who killed him. Russian Revolution.
Silly nobles.
So, yeah.
They should put the knob in nobility, am I right?
Yeah. Thing is, I reckon, because you like Rasputin as a character, as much as I do, I reckon you'd love the Shadow Hearts games.
Is Rasputin like a crazy angry warlock man in those?
They've got Roger Bacon as a character. You know, scientist adventure Roger Bacon?
Excellent, yes.
Yeah, he's a wizened old man. You got a guy whose soul is being torn apart by demons as your main hero, or anti-hero. You have a British guy who is supposedly evil, called Albert Simon, who you end up defeating in the first game. That's the whole point of the first game. But then in the second game, you're up against one of your oldest friends, and you're up against Rasputin.
I see Rasputin should just be the final boss of every game.
Ah, Rasputin isn't the final boss. And also...
Well, he should be.
Oh,
every
no.
Every game. What's that? You drop Bowser into the lava, but he's rising back. Oh, no, wait, no, it's Rasputin.
Well, this
you thought Kingdom Hearts couldn't get any more confusing? Surprise, here's Grigory Rasputin.
This is the thing. Shadow Hearts Covenant, the sequel to Shadow Hearts, took the entirety of the first game, every single thing you did, and said, everything you did in the first game, yeah, you might have been fighting for what you thought were the right reasons, but your reasons were actually totally wrong.
So I like that. That sounds fun.
Yeah, so where you might be feeling like a total hero by finishing the first game, but halfway through the second game, you're like, oh, well, shit.
I've done a whoopsies.
Yeah, I think I just destroyed the world.
Cut to, you're the best around. Nothing's going to ever bring you down. Like, it's one of, in my mind, that is one of, like, a handful of songs where you can just apply it to anything and it immediately becomes hilarious.
Do you know, you said that, and that's a perfect segue for me to move on to mine.
Excellent.
Yeah, because you know how Wolverine is the best at what he does, and what he does is just annoy the situation and make it go out of control?
Indeed, I do know that.
Well, there's another character. Again, when we were talking about video games, perfect segue. There's another character who also kind of annoys the situation and makes it go out of control, but also tries to fix it as well. And that is Master Chief from the Halo games.
Greg Wallace himself.
No, there's no buttery biscuit bases or soggy bottoms or anything like that.
I think I find in the games we've never actually seen Master Chief's real face.
He might be Greg Wallace, you never know. But apparently in this, he's called John sometimes. So anyway, I have a plethora of Halo, starting off with a Master Chief story called Halo Collateral Damage. It's written by Alex Irvin, and it's got art from David Crossland, and it's a nice little hardback. It's basically just your standard Halo story, lots of guys in Spartan outfits posing while shooting their guns.
I mean, I feel like when you say Spartan outfits, we have very different pictures in our heads.
I'm not on about kilts and bronze swords and stuff like that.
Just flat out leather 300 style thongs.
Yeah, I'm not on about those. I'm on about Spartans from the Halo universe who basically wear armor and helmets and fire guns and stuff like that. Those sorts of Spartans.
I know.
See, this is your typical Commonwealth Garden Halo type story where there's a mission, the Spartans have to go in, have to sort stuff out, moving on, yada, yada, yada. Fairly bog standard stuff. The reason I'm getting this one out of the way and not really going into detail about it is because I absolutely hate the artwork. Now, Dave Crossland, you might be great at some of the scenery, you might be great at spaceships and stuff like that, but you're horrible at faces. Everybody in this looks constipated or stoic or is scowling or is downright angry.
So you say that, but also those are like the three emotions of Halo Land.
They are. I mean, it's got some nice redesigning of Spartan bits at the back, you know, where it goes into character models and stuff like that. But aside from that, you've basically just got loads of people shooting at loads of aliens who are shooting back at loads of people, and lots of ships being destroyed. Commonwealth Garden Halo story. And this kind of is one of the problems with doing comic book adaptations of certain types of video game. Now, Halo has a lot of built-up story around the games themselves. But for the early games, the story was kind of a little bit piecemeal. It wasn't until the later games that they started focusing on the narrative a bit more. And that's one of the things about this being a Master Chief story. They've focused far too much on Master Chief as a character. But Master Chief as a character is basically a blank canvas. He doesn't really have a personal history. You can't really associate with any of his motives other than, this is the job I'm supposed to do, so I'm going to do this job.
Yeah, Master Chief's character arc is going from saying, I like to use this gun to shoot the aliens too. I like to use this even bigger gun to shoot the aliens.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the weird relationship he has with, well, let's see, how would you describe it? The increasingly sexy artificial intelligence of the ship called Cortana. Because from the first Halo game onwards, they used a sexier and sexier model for Cortana in the games.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, and
I mean, that was definitely old John Halo just buying those upgrade packs.
Yeah, I know. Aside from the weird relationship...
From those deep websites.
Yeah, aside from the weird relationship he's got going on with Cortana, I mean, he's been alone in space with her for 4 years.
So John Halo, I don't know, that's not his name, but I'm going to keep calling it anyway. He's eschewed basically all human contact to spend more time with his digital girlfriend.
Well, not
quite. Is Master Chief a weeb?
No, not quite. Not quite. See, there is a type of relationship form that humans have called autophilia, where men fall in love with their cars, and Master Chief has a giant spaceship. I don't know what you'd call that.
Overcompensation is what I'd call it.
So anyway, we move on to the second portion of Halo. Now this is...
Oh my god, I should play EVE Online or something just so I can build a massive spaceship and call it the Overcompensator.
Anyway, moving on to the Halo Omnibus Volume 1, which is basically kind of a tome of a book. And this one is actually written by Brian Reed, Chris Schlerf, Duffy Boudreau, with art by Marco Castillo, Sergio Arino, Ricardo Sanchez, Douglas Franchin, inks by Marco Castillo, Juan Castro, Rob Lean, Dennis Freitas, Jason Gorder, Carlos Eduardo, and colours by Michael Atiyeh, and letters by Michael Heisler. And it's got the front cover art by Jean-Sebastien Rosbach. And this one actually is better than the Collateral Damage volume in just about every single way. Because this isn't actually a Master Chief story for the most part. This is collecting the stories of Halo Initiation 1 to 3, Halo Escalation 1 to 12, and it's focusing on the stories around Halo ODST, Halo 5 Guardians, that sort of thing, right? So it's less about Master Chief, and it starts off with an old Spartan who's now wheelchair bound. And he's talking about what happened with the first generation of Spartans, how that doctor who created the Spartans kidnapped children from their parents and subjected them to various genetic experiments, killed loads of children, but eventually created the Spartans, which included Master Chief. He goes on to say, the Spartans have been the backbone of human defense for, and now without them, things are starting to break apart. We need the Spartans. So I went ahead and made some. But he didn't focus on children. He got the best soldiers he could find, and he gave them the Spartan treatment and turned them into Spartans. But they're up against a rogue Spartan. A Spartan who also got the same sort of treatment but went rogue and is a little bit mad. And is out for money. And I have to say, the artwork in this is a lot better. Mainly because the characters in this do smile from time to time.
Smiling? In Halo?
Yeah, I know. It's shocking, isn't it? Everyone is stern and stuff like that on the job. But the characters do smile from time to time. Also, it shows the alien characters in a better light than in that Collateral Damage one. They were kind of scratchy in the depiction of them, but in this, there's a kind of elegance about the alien depictions as well. So you get the sense that the aliens are just another life form, like humans, rather than being something that you need to automatically go up against. It's depicting how it's not just the aliens, but the humans are also part of the enemy of this new galactic order of things. And so you have humans betraying humans, you have aliens betraying aliens, you have aliens betraying humans, and everybody's betraying each other. Even Spartans betraying other Spartans, which, you know, perish the thought. It goes on in this storyline that I actually quite enjoyed. I thought it was really interesting. It's a lot more complex than I expected it to be, a lot more complex than that Collateral Damage was. There are multiple threads running through the story, some political, some military, some diplomatic, and some scientific. Master Chief does show up in this later on, in the later stories, when he comes back from his sojourn in space with Cortana, and he has to kill Dudact all over again. And one of the other things about this is that it heavily includes characters of colour. Not just alien characters, but characters of colour.
Oh, neat, yeah, because especially, I think Halo, and especially a lot of the games from around that kind of time, are very heavily in the, this is your muscly white man protagonist.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the only protagonist type that exists.
Yep. I've got to say, the Halo Omnibus is a much better read than Halo Collateral Damage, the Master Chief story on its own. And the Master Chief story in the Halo Omnibus is a much better read than the standalone Master Chief story. So overall, I'd say if you're a fan of Halo, avoid Collateral Damage, focus on the Omnibus, just get yourself the Omnibus and be happy.
I mean, truly, that's advice we can all live by, isn't it? Avoid Collateral Damage.
Basically, yes.
God, that's some delicious irony.
I know.
Wait, shall we stick with big, angry, armoured sci-fi people?
Yes.
So, I have been reading the fourth, and as it turns out, final volume of Darth Vader.
Ooh.
Is, as with the rest of the series, is written by Charles Soule, with art by Giuseppe Camuncoli, with inks by Danielle Orlandini and Terry Pallett, and colours by David Curiel, Dono Sanchez Almara, and Eric Arcinega.
So what's been happening with Dark Helmet these days?
Well, Mr. Stroppy Pants himself has been leading his elite force of Jedi hunters, known as the Inquisitors, to hunt down the last remaining Jedi after the Sith kind of, well, I say him and Palpatine, have engineered their downfall at the end of Revenge of the Sith.
That was Order 66, wasn't it?
It was indeed, which is only three orders away from the best one.
No. No, it's not.
I'm sure I what Palpatine looks like and made myself deeply upset.
Exactly.
I think once again I need to cancel the show and leave immediately.
Hey, you did it, not me. You can't blame that one on me.
So yeah, this one has two stories in it. The first is a short two-parter where Darth Vader basically hunts down Eeth Koth, who is like the last surviving member of the Jedi Council, kills him. And basically, during the course of this, he sends some of his Inquisitors to go kidnap Heathcliff's baby. But the Inquisitor who does it, she... basically, it looks like she's going to let the mother and the baby escape off planet. Only then he uses a force power to kind of snatch the baby away. But it's unclear, like, if she's doing that deliberately as a, like, just an extra cruel trick, which is what she says she's done, or if she kind of saw, oh, wait, no, reinforcements are coming, they can see what's going on, and I need to kind of save my own bacon here, or I'll be in trouble. And I think that ambiguity is important, because then the next issue, Darth Vader just decides to go after her and kill her. And I like that it's kind of, it's deliberately unclear how much it is.
Yeah.
He knows that she's a traitor versus, because Ithkoth was the last major Jedi they needed to hunt down. And so without that, Darth Vader kind of doesn't have a purpose anymore. And like, there's kind of the implication that maybe he's just throwing himself at even the most flimsy of reasons, just so like he doesn't have to stop and think about what an awful person he's become. So that's fun. And then we move on to the final storyline, which is basically about how Darth Vader got his fancy castle that we saw in Rogue One.
Ooh.
So, yeah, Vader returns to Mustafar, the planet where he fought Obi-Wan Kenobi and got all his limbs chopped it off.
Yep.
And there's kind of a fun twist where it starts off, basically goes with, like, the top Imperial architect who starts trying to design. Basically, he has, like, a whole monologue about how the toughest design clients are always the ones who say, I don't care, do whatever you want. Because they inevitably always come back and say, no, actually, this doesn't work, I don't want it. And like it kind of sets up that they're going to have this kind of back and forth relationship where she's going to keep designing stuff and he's going to say, nah, I don't like it. Only for her to promptly get shot and die. It turns out the person who shot her is her own assistant wearing a mysterious mask that Darth Vader had brought with him. And to that, this is the mask of Lord Momin, a powerful dark side user. And basically, he's a fun character, I like him. He was basically one of the ancient Sith who decided instead of just, you know, being a generic bad, I'm evil, I'm going to take over the galaxy. Like, he dedicated himself to proving the beauty of the dark side through works of art.
So, hang on. Is he like the evil version of Kevin MacLeod from Grand Designs?
Yeah, basically. I mean, much like Kevin MacLeod, he believes that art is only meaningful if it provokes an emotional response. And there's no truer emotional response than fear and disgust. Like, he's great. Is he his masterpiece that he was going to try and create at the time of his death was to basically fire a gigantic laser that destroyed an entire planet, but then freeze time kind of like at the point of impact, just as everyone on the planet realized they were going to die. And that was going to be like his eternal monument to the dark side.
Wow.
Yeah, but instead he gets kind of roped into helping Darth Vader build his castle, because it turns out he doesn't just want a castle. He wants what's effectively going to act like a dark side tuning fork. Because it turns out all along Darth Vader's whole goal was to sort of step outside of reality. Of maybe like go into the afterlife and save Padme, which doesn't go well.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, you know, I think again, since this is a very spoiler heavy show, I am going to go for it because the final issue was really great. Basically, Darth Vader going into like the afterlife. I like that he's represented kind of how we've seen him when he's meditating.
Yeah,
where it's like this being of pure light, but like all from like his face down to his legs is just horribly scarred. Like, well, basically, like, his physical scars are like a representation of the corruption that's taken over his soul. And he basically just has to fight his way through, like, every other Jedi, like, all the ones he's killed and met and sort of betrayed just to get to Padme. And when he does, she basically says to him, Anakin Skywalker's dead, and throws herself off a ledge.
Ouch.
It's just really bad the way it ends. Because basically Darth Vader storming out of his castle, and then Palpatine calls him up to say, what was it what you needed? It just ends with, well, I say Anakin, Darth Vader saying yes. It's like, this is the point where like all traces of Anakin Skywalker are gone. He is just like an emotionless killing machine.
Which is basically what Darth Vader is, all the way until he meets his son.
Exactly. And I like seeing like that continuation on from the prequel films.
Yeah. See, this is the kind of story that we needed the movies to be.
Yeah, basically, like, the prequels had so much potential to be, like, interesting stories.
Yeah.
And instead, we found out key character points, like he doesn't like sand because it's coarse and it gets everywhere. So I think the character stuff is good. The art's always good. Giuseppe, what's his face? Cameron Coley, you know, he's one of those very solid artists where just everything looks clean and like nicely detailed. There's also a very good bit that I like, where it's basically while Lord Momin is like building the castles, and like this kind of recurring thing of like he'll build the castle, Darth Vader will go in, but then the energies of the dark side will be too much and it will explode. And we just like get a montage of just like, here we are, Lord Vader. Sixth time's the charm, as they say. Castle explodes. I have confidence that the seventh design. Castle explodes. Eighth, mark my words. And then it just goes, I understand why you might have lost a bit of faith in me at this point. But I've said all along that this is a process. And my ninth design. Also, adding to that, like I kind of hinted at before, Lord Momin, his essence is just in the mask. And so for each scene, his mask is just like on a different body.
Yeah, I like that as well.
He's just got like really knocked off and killed his body.
I like that.
It is. It's a very good gag. I think the only complaint I'd have is probably with some of the action. Because I think it's an inherent problem with Darth Vader that I think Charles Soule doesn't really manage to get around. Is he's not the kind of person who really like outsmarts his opponent. He wins his fights because he's better than you. And there's basically two types of fights in Darth Vader. Either Darth Vader effortlessly crushes everyone without breaking a sweat, or Darth Vader like gets the crap beaten out of him until he realizes, oh wait, I can just smush him with the Force. And then he does that.
Yep.
Like literally the main two fights in this book end with Darth Vader's opponent standing over him, gloating. And then Darth Vader just goes, yeah, but no, now you're dead. Especially, he's a Sith, and you're also a Sith. You should know that, like, he can just smash you with a big old block, even if he doesn't have a weapon in his hands.
Yep.
Yeah, overall, still a good fun read.
Okay, my turn, is it?
It is indeed.
And I have Just Call for Four.
Fantastic Four, but actually the series is bad.
Well, it is and it isn't. Let's get into this. This is Fantastic Four, Volume 1, I believe, Forever. Volume 1 of the new Fantastic Four series. This is written by Dan Slott with art by Sarah Pickle. Sarah Pichelli.
Sarah Pickle.
The H looked like a K. Art by Sarah Pichelli. Nico Leon, Stefano Caselli, Simone Bianchi, and Scotty Young. And it's got inks by Sarah Pichelli and Elisabetta D'Amico, colours by Mato Gracia, Eric Arciniega, Simon Bianchi, and Marco Russo, and Jeremy Trees. And letters by VC's Joe Caramagna.
Him again?
Yeah, him again. Anyway, this starts off with, this is after the whole Battle World, Secret Wars type thing. Reed and Sue, and what were they called? That collective, the kids, all the geniuses?
The Future Foundation.
Reed and Sue and the Future Foundation, they haven't made it back to Earth. And Johnny and Ben, they're all that's left of the Fantastic Four on Earth. And so they're trying to cope. Then all of a sudden, there's a sign from the top of the Baxter building. It says Fantastic Four. Johnny flies off to it and he finds a couple of the Yancey Street kids there. He wants to press charges because they've basically been on top of the Baxter building. Only for him to run into Jennifer, who is... who's Wyatt? I've forgotten who Wyatt is.
Oh, Wyatt Wilmcote, Johnny's best friend.
Yeah.
His very best. They're such good friends, Rob.
Yeah.
They're very, very good friends.
Yeah. Well, apparently his very, very good friend had a thing with Jennifer at one point. You know Jennifer? She-Hulk Jennifer?
Yeah.
And so Jennifer's not pressing charges against... she's basically defending the kids, and Ben has dropped all the charges. Ben is looking through some of the old stuff from the Baxter Building, and he's recalling a time when they were on their way through with a new friend called Astronomica, and she knew her way around the stars, and they were trying to get back to Earth, and the way to do it was singing. And it's got this beautiful moment. It's the kind of moment that you'd only get in the Fantastic Four, where it's very much a family one, where Astronomica says, "We're running out of time. Your best singer, tell me now." And Sue goes, "It's me." But everyone else goes, "Johnny." And Johnny on the other panel, kind of bookended panels between the Storm siblings, with Sue going, "Me," and Johnny going, "Me." But everyone's saying, "Johnny." And that's just basically Sue going, "Wait, Johnny? Really?" And then she goes to Reed. "Reed, you said you loved my singing." "Subjectively, yes, but objectively, as a scientist, I have to say that Johnny's timbre is... Sorry, dear, I have to steer the ship."
Oh, you nerd.
He knows when he's going to put a foot wrong, though. That's the thing. He's been married long enough now.
See, if this book was just like that scene, I'd be very much down for it.
Yeah, that's literally it. And if this book was just more about how the Fantastic Four are a family first, it would have been just amazing. And it has some lovely bits in this very first story. Ben proposing to Alicia. It's about bloody time.
Yeah, I feel like this first issue was the one that got me excited for the series.
Yeah, same with me. First issue got me excited for the series. I was so looking forward to the rest of the series based on the first issue, especially the Doctor Doom bit at the end of the first issue. And the signal in the sky with the giant four that's actually larger than Earth in the sky. And the whole bit with Doctor Doom returning to Latveria, finding that the people are all but enslaved. And while he's spent time away trying to be a hero, he's suffered for it and he's paid the price for being a hero. He says to the young lady who's invaded the castle looking for him, she begs him to help, and she says, "Your motherland has suffered scars in your absence. She's endured dictators and strongmen. Trust me, she would more than welcome any face of doom. But what she needs to see is your true face," and holds up his mask, the original Doctor Doom mask. See, that again, I'd love just a Doctor Doom story focused on his protection and development of Latveria. As we've discussed before, the rest of the world might see him as a supervillain, but to the Latverians, he's a saviour. He's like a messiah.
Yeah, and that's what makes him interesting.
Yeah, it's those kind of details that make Doctor Doom such an interesting character, because
it's the fact that he's got this capacity for great good.
Yeah,
but he's going to end up blowing it all on some petty scheme to get back at Reed Richards.
Yeah, but he loves his homeland. He loves it. He loves the land where he came from, and he'll do whatever he needs to do to protect it. You know, you might call that dictatorship, you might call that tyranny, but the Latverians love him.
You know, he would do anything for love, but he won't do that. That being very specifically anything that would make him like not be the smartest person in the room.
Yeah, which is...
I feel like that's the core of Doctor Doom, is he wants to be good, but also he cares about himself more than anyone else.
Yeah. So anyway, it moves on from there to where Reed and Sue and the Future Foundation actually are, and you have Val, Reed's daughter, who is flirting with an alien...
No.
Yeah, she's flirting with a hunky alien.
I mean, not just I believe the terms the hunky alien specifically uses is, "You should join my harem."
Yeah, I know.
To the 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, and I'm just going, yeah, no.
Not enough soap. None of us will ever be clean enough.
See, I like some of the calmer moments between Sue and Reed, and I like some of the moments where they're actually being parents, proper parents to the Future Foundation. But then all of a sudden, Sexy female spider Entropy, who apparently is a universal force of destruction and ending, but apparently the anthropomorphic version is a sexy female alien spider type thing.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you could just replace all of what you've said with the bad thing.
Yeah, but they had to make the bad thing sexy. Reed makes a point, you wouldn't beat us if all of us were here. She goes, okay, call all of you. Gives him a machine. So he calls all of them. All of the Fantastic Four, as in every single person who's been a member of the Fantastic Four, which leads to some funny bits between Johnny and Iceman, Johnny and Bobby. But
I think they're establishing that at some point in the past, Bobby Drake joined the Fantastic Four for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, and the thing is, it was very much an off-screen thing. It wasn't something that was noted down in any comic, but apparently it happened. And because it happened in this series, it's now official. It's now canon.
Yeah, well, I think the idea is it's going to come up at some point in the future as like a flashback adventure.
Yeah, that was one of the nice bits in this. But I hate the fact that they keep referring to Franklin as some kind of god. It doesn't make sense. And then when they get back, there's the staged thing with the Fantastics and the Wrecking Crew and everything like that. And it just, that left a sour taste in my mouth. I like the Fantastic Four. I think that the whole idea of the Fantastic Four from the very beginning was such a good idea. And some of the storylines they've had in the Fantastic Four, where it deals specifically with the family relationships, with the family dynamic, and with the fact that they're adventurers, explorers, scientists, before they're even superheroes. That's the thing that they should be focusing on with the Fantastic Four. They didn't need to do the whole Entropy thing wants to destroy the godchild Franklin Richards. They didn't need any of that nonsense. They didn't need any of that stuff. They could have just said, look, Reed eventually is smart enough to figure out a way to get them home. He just needs the rest of the Fantastic Four to come and help him. That's it.
Yeah, to further, he didn't even need to figure out. Like, they chose to be not in the universe anymore.
Yeah, they chose to be. And the thing is, they could make it back under their own power. It might have taken Reed a bit more time, but he would have eventually done it, especially as he's got the Future Foundation with him.
So I think just this whole thing is kind of, it's a bit of a damp squib.
Yes, it is.
Sorry. Oh, look, this is my new villain, and she's the most powerful, and she's the baddest, and oh, so strong. And her motives are so vast, you could never guess them, but she's real bad news, buddy, believe me. And now they've got to fight her with just all the punching.
Yep.
This is the return of the Fantastic Four. You should be smashing this out the park.
Yeah. It should be the triumphant return of the first family of superheroes.
Also, dance that screws over the Future Foundation so badly.
Yeah, I know. And that, I think, is, you know, I think the Future Foundation is probably one of the most wasted assets that Marvel have. There is so much they could do with that, especially as they've got Moon Girl and Riri Williams, and they had the Wasp trying to do that Girl Science Club type thing, right?
You could just tie all that in and just like have a nice big old Future Foundation.
That's what I'm saying. Bring them all into the Future Foundation, and you could have the Future Foundation as this this team kind of thing. So they're not the champions. They're not Kamala and Miles and the rest of them. They're not that team. They're not kind of Young Avengers type team. They're basically a team whose main efforts are dedicated towards solving certain real problems of the world.
Yeah, well they're not a superhero team. They are a school.
Yeah.
But nope, instead, what if they help the Fantastic Four save the world and say, okay, we're going to piss off forever now.
So anyway.
Dance slot.
Great first issue. After that, it was just no. Moving on to you, Andrew.
Yeah, so actually, we've been getting on quite a bit, so I might make this the final thing. I've been reading Cosmic Ghost Rider. Baby Thanos must die.
I love the image on the back of that.
Yeah, with just weird space ghost rider with pickle baby Thanos asleep on his head.
Yes.
So this is written by Donny Cates with art for Cosmic Ghost Rider issues 1-5 by Dylan Burnett and colors by Antonio Fabella, and art for Thanos Legacy issue 1 by Brian Level and colors by Jordan Boyd. I've got letters by VC's Clayton Cowles. The other one.
Yes.
So Cosmic Ghost Rider, he is Frank Castle, who is from a future where he was like Thanos' right-hand man, because he got the powers of both Ghost Rider and the Silver Surfer, and it made him go a bit mad. And then he died, and he went to Valhalla, but then he got brought back, and now he's decided he's going to try and raise Thanos to not be a monster. But in the words of Uatu the Watcher, yeah, he appeared to watch what might be the single worst decision by any sentient creature in the galaxy, which is Frank Castle saying, yeah, I can totally raise Thanos to not be a monster.
Well,
yeah, and then he has a big fight with... But one of the ideas I like in this is that just by saying that, he creates a timeline in which he raised Thanos. And so immediately, a time-traveling group of Guardians of the Galaxy come to fight him. And this is a weird Guardians of the Galaxy team, because you've got Cable, you've got Jubilee, you've got Captain Marvel, who's a grown-up Kamala Khan, Iron Groot, is it Iron Groot or is it Iron Man? It's Rocket Raccoon wearing like an Iron Man suit made out of Groot. And a character who I think my single biggest criticism of this book is that he only appears in like a couple of panels and then dies. The Jugger Duck.
The what?
The Jugger Duck. What if Howard the Duck got the Crimson Gem of Sidorak and became the Juggernaut?
Oh my god, that's the most amazing thing I've ever heard.
It is. I feel like if not for the fact that he doesn't get any lines and gets killed off very quickly, I'd give this book a free pass.
Even with that, I now want The Adventures of Jugger Duck. Which...
yeah, that's... I'd read that. I'd like that more than Cosmic Ghost. Because Cosmic Ghost Rider, I guess... I don't get the point.
Remember that Thanos story where they first introduced Frank Castle as Ghost Rider?
I mean, I haven't actually read that, but...
It was Thanos Wins?
Yeah, because I think that's actually the series this spins out of.
That one where they introduced Frank Castle as Cosmic Ghost Rider, I kind of got the point of it. But Ghost Rider, or Cosmic Ghost Rider, I think he's better off as a supporting character. He doesn't have the verve and the panache of Deadpool to carry off being prolifically humorous.
Oh, yeah, because that's the kind of garbage explanation, is that because Frank lost his mind, now he just basically acts like Deadpool in space.
Yeah. But Space Deadpool is just still Deadpool.
Yeah, and this is just like, I think it's the fact that he's off-brand Deadpool, and it's very clearly this is Donny Cates' kind of pet character. Because, like, he's the Cosmic Ghost Rider. He's a wild card, and he doesn't play by the rules. But he's also super strong. He can beat up anyone. And then, you know, there's a bit at the bottom of this kind of character sheet where it's just scribbled out. And if you look underneath the scribble, you can see just the words, "And he's my dad."
Okay. This is the thing. Deadpool doesn't need any strength to... Well, Deadpool's probably the only character in the Marvel Universe who can annoy the Watchers to the point where they will leave.
Yeah, basically.
And the Watchers, they're as morbid as rubberneckers on a motorway after an accident. They will watch any kind of disaster.
Yeah, that's the whole shtick. Speaking of shticks, I feel like this has like a kind of good one that it basically wastes. Because it is eventually Frank goes into the future to see the Thanos he's raised, who like has become the Punisher. But he's basically like converted an entire planet into just like a prison camp.
So hang on.
Rules with a ruthless iron fist.
If he's the Thanos Punisher, is he the Thanisher?
Yes, sure. But the point I'm trying to make is I feel like there's an interesting story there about like taking the Punisher's very black and white worldview and sort of saying like, but when you scale it up this big cosmic sense, like it doesn't work. You need to be more nuanced than that.
See, that's the thing. That's where the nature versus nurture argument comes in, and that would have been a really interesting angle to approach it from, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But no, it's just basically he sees future Thanos and goes, oh no, you're still bad, I gotta kill you. And it's just like I say, that there was never really a point where this book clicked for me where I could say, like, oh, this is why this thing exists.
Yeah.
Because like it's just it's a weird mishmash of a character doing some stuff, and also blah blah blah. Is there any redemption for me, or am I just a monster? I don't know, but I've got to keep trying. I'd hope someone can wake me up inside. Can't wake up. Let the bodies hit the floor. Emo rock.
Yeah.
That's Cosmic Ghost Rider. He's just Deadpool who got hit by like a new metal early 2000s emo rock song.
Yeah.
They can punish Nessence.
Yep.
The art's really good though. Dylan Burnett is like, he's fantastic. He does like very cartoony, exaggerated art that just like it's so expressive and very kinetic, and I love it. He's currently doing the art on X-Force. But Dylan Burnett is a great artist who gets saddled on books that I really don't care for, and it sucks.
Hmm.
Give Dylan Burnett a book I actually like so I can buy more of it.
Yeah. So, question. Do we have enough time to round this off on something positive?
Actually, yeah, we probably should.
Because we can if you want, and you know what I have as the last thing.
Yeah, you do. Okay, crack open some good times.
Let the good times roll, because we're heading to the West Coast.
Oh, yeah, West Coast, baby.
Yeah, it is the best coast, because the West Coast Avengers are back, and my God, it is so much fun.
Such a good, goofy team.
I think
that's the volume where we meet Jeff the Lancher.
Just wait, let me get the introductions out of the way first. So, this is written by Kelly Thompson, with art by Stefano Caselli, colours by Triona Farrell, letters by VC's Joe Caramagna, again, and it's got cover art by Stefano Caselli and Nolan Woodward. So this is about Kate Bishop, not about Clint Barton. And Kate Bishop, who is also known as Hawkeye, has recently moved out to California to start a new life as a private investigator. So far, she's been able to handle everything the West Coast has thrown at her, but it's been throwing a lot harder lately, and by a lot harder, it starts off with Clint, male Hawkeye, being interviewed. First question he says is, which camera am I on? The one right in front is fine. So then he starts talking about why Kate Bishop was chosen as the leader of the West Coast Avengers. And in the background, you've got Kate's boyfriend just kind of, oh, crap, there's a camera there, and just quickly shuffling across the screen. Meanwhile, Kate is trying to call Clint. This goes back in time to 4 weeks ago, because she is currently trying to herd a bunch of land sharks. These are sharks with legs that have come out of the water and are randomly attacking stuff.
Land sharks!
Yep. America Chavez pulls Clint into the action, and all the way throughout this first issue, there are interviews with the various members of the West Coast Avengers. America basically is America, and you got Kate's boyfriend, Johnny Watts, also known as Fuse. He's kind of like the Absorbing Man a little bit, isn't he?
Yeah, which threw me off, because I initially thought he'd have, like, electricity powers or something.
Yeah.
Like a fuse. Not yeah. As in, like, fusing things.
Yeah, but, you know, his powers do make sense. So anyway, they eventually beat the Land Sharks. Kate's just kind of, why me, and Clint says, you need to make a team. So she puts out a wanted ad. I mean, it's just so Los Angeles. It's just like...
I love the responses she gets as well.
Yeah, I was going to go through some of them. She goes through the interviews. The first one is, she calls him Toast. He goes, no, my name's Bread, not Toast. And he goes, I have a great catchphrase. And she goes, let me guess, you're Toast. He goes, no, I'm Bread, not Toast. And she goes, okay, what's the catchphrase? She goes, he's like, he goes, she goes, no, no, I really want to hear it. I'll butter your bread.
Bread.
Yeah. And then you've got somebody who is, she's a diva, and she wants to meet the male Hawkeye, you know, the cute one. Kate's going, we're both cute. And then she says, you know he's gay, right? And there's the Spider King, Surf Doctor, the Broken Watch, Twice a Day He's Right. The Dark Paladin, who is basically Batman, he puts his cape in front of his face, goes, evil lurks. Kate just says, way, way too damn dark. Then you got Kate's friends, Quinn, Ramon, and Mika. The Scorp, who is just short for Scorpion. Dr. Mole, who was at the wrong place. He thought he was attending an audition for the Mole Men of Los Angeles.
There's Wolvermane as well.
Oh, God, I was getting to Wolvermane, but Silver Snowboarder, whose powers only work around snow. The Dutch Oven is one of the funniest. It's just a guy wrapped in a quilt.
And do you know why that is, Rob?
Yes, I know what Dutch Oven is. And then Wolvermane, who's basically styled his hair to look like Wolverine and has not very good steak knives.
He's just like holding a bunch of knives in his hand. Because there's one of them a fork.
No, they're steak knives. They're steak knives. But then Gwenpool turns up, not for the audition, but to invite Kate for some tacos before she leaves town. And Kate immediately assumes Gwenpool is there to join the team. Says, you're hired immediately. Because Gwenpool might be mad as a Hatter and might have fourth dimension breaking powers, which not a lot of people know about. I don't know if Kate actually knows about them. But Gwenpool is a known entity and it's known that she can get certain jobs done. Quentin Quire arrives with a camera crew, wanting to be part of the team.
She decided she's going to be a celebrity now.
Yeah. Then it just keeps going through these different interviews, and then they get their first job. So it's basically America. I mean, this is after Gwenpool has pranked Quire by filling his room with like 200 wet towels.
Because he leaves his on the floor.
Yeah. And so.
Those kids.
Yeah, I know. So they go for their first job. It's Fuse and both Hawkeyes. Gwenpool, America Chavez, Quentin Quire, and lo and behold, it's Attack of the 50-Foot Tigra. And the thing that I love about that particular image when they show you the 50-Foot Tigra is it's exactly the same pose as Daryl Hannah in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Yeah, that's a fun reference.
So it's a very Hollywood reference, and everyone's trying to sort stuff out. Clint is trying to talk Tigra down.
Who's going to come to save the day, Rob?
Yeah, I know. The person who comes to save the day, he appears and immediately gives Kate a kiss, and he is Brodok, the biorobotic organism designed overwhelmingly for kissing, and Brodok will save you all.
Because, like, first of all, he's clearly MODOK.
Yeah.
And second of all, his body is like a surfer dude body with a slightly too large head.
Exactly.
That's really disconcerting.
I know. And it's just. It's bizarre, but it somehow works so well. And what I love about this is they keep trying to explain MODOK to Brodok, and Brodok's fascinated by water.
Just like an ordinary human being, which he totally is.
Oh no, I love it when they go into his life story and they change the art style so it looks like, you know, the old 1950s flashbacks from a pulp novel. And Gwen's going, I love this story, don't you guys? And everyone else is like, yeah, absolutely unbelievable. Unbelievable is the word. So everyone knows.
My favorite thing is just the fact that no one for a second believes it isn't MODOK.
Yeah. Everybody knows it's MODOK. Meanwhile, Quire and Gwenpool are arguing and arguing, but Brodok, being the master of love that he is, has immediately sensed the undertones between Quentin and Gwenpool. And he's like, I don't think they do hate each other. You know, his point is proven when they both say, you are the worst, stare at each other, then start kissing.
And everyone is disgusted.
Yeah, America and Fuse, they're like, no, it's burned into my retinas. Quentin Quire was kissing someone.
Yes, it is. But as good as it is, West Coast Avengers is actually a crime.
Yeah, I know. See, this deserves so much more love than it gets. It's so much fun. Especially when you get Attack of the 50-Foot Kator.
Yeah.
I love the fact that the 50-Foot characters keep appearing.
They do. Also, I like, to spoil, I mean, this is a spoiler show, but I like that at the end, there's one of the 50-Foot ladies is just like, now I'm a 50-Foot dragon, now I'm just going to stay like this.
Yeah. She's loving it.
Yeah, which I mean, fair enough.
Yeah. They go on to a talk show later on. It's Jimmy Kimmel, who actually has made it into a comic book. And while they're on there, you got the Eel going, that's what passes for an Avenger these days. You got Satana going, and I just relocated, how tiresome. You got Graviton going, well, there goes the neighborhood. The Dutch Oven is at home going, reject me at your peril, West Coast Avengers. And Madame Mask replying to Jimmy Kimmel saying, the West Coast Avengers are back in business. She goes, not on my watch, they're not. And do you know what this reminds me of? You remember we were talking about Great Lakes Avengers?
Yeah, it is very Great Lakes Avengers-esque, that yeah. same kind of wacky sensibility.
Yep, it totally is. The other thing about this is it has a Gwenpool story at the end, which, you know, I do like my Gwenpool.
Also, do you have realised?
What?
Madame Mask comes off as being, like, really creepy and menacing at the end of that.
Yeah.
Until you realise that she's just standing at home yelling at her TV screen.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the funniest things about it. I love the Dutch oven's response. Reject me, will you?
You fools, you've made your greatest supervillain.
You've made your bed, and I'm lying in it.
Okay, the show's definitely cancelled now.
Yeah, we're all done. So, if you want to listen to any of our previous episodes, you'll find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or whichever podcast provider you choose to use. You'll also find them on YouTube, so do check it out there as well. You can find other things on our website, reviews, and our Patreon, our shop, everything like that. That's just about it from us. We'll be back next week, when hopefully Mick will be back as well. Until then, I have been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.